Philip Winslow's 20-year-long career in journalism began in local TV and radio, but it eventually led him to become the Southern African correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor and to covering events like the genocide in Rwanda. As a natural progression of his journalistic career, Mr. Winslow became involved with peacekeeping missions in the former Yugoslavia and Sierra Leone, and in 2001 he began working for the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees. In his latest book, Victory for Us is to See You Suffer, Mr. Winslow documents his 2.5 years working with Palestinian refugees in the West Bank. It's published by Beacon Press, and I'm very pleased to welcome Philip C. Winslow to the show today. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So where did you begin your longtime career in journalism?
Where did I begin it? In Rochester, New York, back in the 60s.
And did you grow up in Canada? Because so much of your career has been involved with Canadian newspapers, radio, and television.
No. I grew up in the States, and it was just kind of an accident. I just happened to be offered a job in Montreal with one of the old Montreal daily papers during the sort of golden days of journalism there.
Do you think that it led you to have a different perspective because Canadians are both like people in this country, and also I know they're often bemused by us?
Very much. I, working in Canada for a Canadian news organization, was very much a mind-opening experience. It's like there's other ways of looking at the world than the way we had in the States when I was a kid.
Before you were posted in overseas, weren't you working on radio documentaries on world events? Berlin Wall, the fall of communism?
Yes, but that came later. Working, doing radio documentaries and then television, those were with Canadian news organizations from London. I moved to London to cover the Middle East in the mid-'80s, early 80s.
And then you became the South African correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor.
The Monitor Radio. The Christian Science Monitor had a radio network
Yes.
at the time, so I was the radio guy in Southern Africa for a couple of years.
This sounds like you were moving up the journalistic ladder. So how did you wind up going from journalism to humanitarian work? Was it a natural transition?
No, probably not. I had poor planning. Actually, not to slight humanitarian aid work, but I think I quite frankly didn't plan my professional career awfully well.
Were you willing to give up your journalistic career?
Yeah, sure. It was, I guess I wanted to do something that was a bit more hands-on. And the way it came about initially was I was covering the war in the former Yugoslavia for the Monitor Radio. And I was offered a job in the then peacekeeping mission UNPROFOR at the time. So it gave me a bit of a taste for it.
Well, a number of journalists have told me that they felt frustration in covering things because they have to remain outside the events, and times they just feel that they wish they could pitch in and do something.
That's right, and it's very nice to be, although it can be equally frustrating on the other side of this thing, but working in humanitarian aid, you can certainly get your hands dirty, and it was this aspect of it that I found quite intriguing and satisfying, although journalism is very satisfying as well. I mean, it's a great profession.
Well, you were working in two real firestorms, the former Yugoslavia, where there was a lot of fighting, and then Sierra Leone, which had gone through one of the bloodiest civil wars of recent memory. How involved were you in those things? I mean, what were you doing?
Well, in the former Yugoslavia, and I was only there for a very short time because 2 months into my tour there, the Christian Science Monitor offered me this job as Southern Africa Radio Bureau Chief.
Oh, so you've gone back and forth.
Well, I had, as I say, haven't planned things very well. But in 93, the year before the South African elections, when I was in Yugoslavia, the Christian Science Monitor offered me this thing covering Southern Africa, including the Angolan Civil War, which I did extensively. So that was a very brief bit there. And then Sierra Leone, I wore two hats there. I went in first as a correspondent doing a radio documentary on these mercenaries, South African mercenaries who were operating there at the time. And then later, some years later, I went back to Sierra Leone, but in a UN peacekeeping mission there.
Do you think that your work with UN organizations in these various places prepared you for what you faced when you were working with the UNRWA in the West Bank?
I don't know that anything somehow prepares one adequately for working in the West Bank.
All these things are different, aren't they?
Yeah, they are
all different. Uniquely terrible.
Well, I think they're all different. They're all different stories. Now, the job was very different working in the West Bank, UNRWA, the UN Relief and Works Agency. I was hired as one of a team of internationals in what was called an operations support unit, field operations, to negotiate with the Israel Defense Forces to get humanitarian aid through the checkpoints and into the refugee camps. So that was a total departure from anything to do with press and information.
My guest is Philip C. Winslow. His book, Victory for Us, is To See You Suffer in the West Bank with the Palestinians and the Israelis, published by Beacon. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. I guess what I was asking you is each refugee experience unique? Because you were working with refugees in all these different places.
Yes, certainly. Palestine refugees are not refugees in the sense of people who have fled their country during an emergency like I was with. I mean, I reported about refugees in the Congo, for example, from Rwanda, with this kind of dire emergency, life and death stuff. This thing with Palestine refugees goes back to 1948, and the refugee camps we see now are considerably different from the I mean, they've grown up into small cities, so a totally different refugee environment.
So they function as cities, but they're still called refugee camps?
Legally, they are still refugee camps because of the mandate of UNRWA. They started out in 1950 and 51 with the tent cities. Well, everybody's seen pictures of them in the mud and so forth. And then gradually over the years, because according to the General Assembly resolution that created UNRWA, a, quote, just solution has not been found, so the refugee camps are still called refugee camps. They still house refugees, 1948 refugees, and their descendants.
Although many people have left, so there's a decision that's made. I'll stay here. This is really my home now, at least until something changes. I'm not going to go off to Jordan or Lebanon or some other country.
Sure. I mean, there's now a second generation of people who have, of Palestinians who have grown up in these camps. And not only the camps, by the way, in the West Bank, there are like 19 refugee camps, but there are also dozens or hundreds of small villages and bigger towns, Nablus, Tilkarim, Jenin, and so forth. So, but yes, there are many Palestinians who have grown up in this environment, and Palestine is their home, or what there is of Palestine.
Did you have any preconceptions of how Palestinian refugees would react to your presence? You're an American coming in there working for the UN.
No, I didn't have any preconceptions, but I sure found out straight away how I was regarded as an American. And it's strange, being regarded by both sides, I mean, it was a unique experience. Coming up to a checkpoint where I would be involved in negotiations with Israeli soldiers, I think I got a little bit of an easier ride because of my American accent. You know, a soldier, you know, hears my accent and, you know, immediately would relax. But and then Palestinians, but there was also a lot on the part of Israelis, a lot of antipathy towards UNRWA, some not very good feelings toward the UN in general and specifically to UNRWA because it's become part of the regional furniture, you might say, after 50-some years. And then on the Palestinian side, a lot of the Palestinians, as I say in the book, found us international field officers, kind of dilettantes. You know, they say, well, you're not helping do the one thing we want, which is end the occupation.
So the Israelis often blame the UN for being biased against them. The Palestinians feel that it's really not doing the job right. You're criticized on both sides. What did you find that there were a lot of people who spoke English on both sides?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, most Israelis, I rarely found an Israeli who didn't speak English. And of course, I'd pull up to a checkpoint, and the first question, once they found out I was American, they would say, you know, how are the Boston Celtics doing? I mean, they're basketball mad. But then many, many Palestinians as well. But we worked in teams, one international with a Palestinian assistant who served as translator in the camps and the villages, not so many people would speak English.
What were those checkpoints like? They seemed to be sore points for many Palestinians.
Oh, they're dreadful. I mean, they Palestinians do not have, and this, by the way, I'm not talking about checkpoints just into Israel or into Jerusalem, but checkpoints in the West Bank between or among Palestinian towns in the West Bank. They're very unpleasant. Palestinians have to show a variety of IDs, and they face long waits, and it's uncomfortable and humiliating for them as well.
On the other hand, the Israelis would argue that they've been the victims of suicide bombs and other aggressions, and if they don't do this, they're really not protecting themselves.
That's right, and nobody has any problem, including all Palestinians, or most Palestinians, I would say, has any problem with Israel defending herself. What the argument is just please don't defend yourself at the expense of breaking international law. But yes, and during all the, and I was there throughout the spate of suicide bombings 2000 to 2004, and Israelis were outraged and terrified. I mean, these were terror attacks, and although people have the right under international law to resist occupation, they do not have the right to do so by targeting civilians.
The suicide bombings increased during the time you were there. 2001, there were only a few, and then it just kept on getting, it kind of mushroomed, didn't it?
It did. Actually,
what did that mean to the Palestinians? Because in this country, we hear mostly that Palestinians support the suicide bombings and that the bombers are often treated as martyrs and heroes.
Yeah, they did at the time. I mean, opinion polls that were done in the time I was there showed at times, say 2002, I think, at the height of the Intifada, overwhelming support, like 75% support among Palestinians for the suicide bombings. And by the way, I can say that I certainly didn't make a lot of friends in the Palestinian community at that time because we spent hours driving in the car up and down the West Bank, you know, 600 miles a week. And
shuttling from refugee camp to refugee
from
camp?
From camp to camp and checkpoint to checkpoint. We had other duties, which were also to try to secure the release, negotiate the release of Palestinian, UN Palestinian employees who had been detained or arrested. So, and I should say, by the way, one thing about UNRWA, it operates for Palestine refugees in the West Bank, Gaza, Syria, Jordan, and Lebanon. And they've got a total of something like 25,000 employees, and only 100-plus are internationals. So this is one thing that kind of makes the Israelis, they tend to see it as a Palestinian organization, which
because
it's not.
It's a major employer in the area.
Sure.
Where were you living? You weren't living in one of the camps, were you?
No, I was living in East Jerusalem, Arab East Jerusalem, just north of the city center, but in East Jerusalem.
Did you ever go to the Gaza Strip, which as I understand it, is quite different from the West Bank?
Entirely different, and the situation remains far more dire and grim than the West Bank. No, I was actually only, I had to go to Gaza once to give a lecture about something about unexploded ordnance, but I, most of the time I was, or almost all of the time I worked exclusively in the West Bank.
Do you speak Arabic?
A smattering, enough to, and the same with Hebrew, enough just to make people think that I can speak it, and then I have to back out of it.
Well, the it's interesting that the West Bank is largely controlled. Well, now it's controlled by Fatah, whereas Gaza is controlled by Hamas. But were you aware of the tensions between the two groups when you were there?
There was less of it then than there is now. This disastrous split between Fatah and Hamas really grew up after January 2006 when Hamas took power in Gaza.
Voted into power.
They won the parliamentary elections in 2006, and then it kind of got worse from there at the time. But due to the occupation, though, although there was less Fatah-Hamas rivalry, there were various of the other factions that had started to compete because they were thriving in this sort of hothouse that the occupation actually created. So this was like Islamic Jihad, the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades, and all these militias that, and there was no shortage of weapons, so these had, there was, among those there was.
My guest is Philip C. Winslow. His book, Victory for Us is to See You Suffer. We'll talk about that title in a little bit. The subtitle is In the West Bank with the Palestinians and the Israelis. It's published by Beacon. Stay with us for more. And here Here's a quick reminder about our new Thanksgiving cartoon contest. We are asking you, our listeners, to create a cartoon about the funny side of Thanksgiving. The New Yorker Magazine's cartoon editor, Robert Mankoff, will choose his favorites and discuss them on the air on the day before Thanksgiving. That's Wednesday, November 21st. The deadline for submitting is Wednesday, November 14th at noon. So you should start scribbling now if you haven't already begun. To submit your cartoon, go to our show page at WNYC.org and then follow the instructions. We're back with Philip C. Winslow, who has been both a journalist and somebody involved with aid work, and he's written about his experiences working for the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees in a book called Victory for Us is to See You Suffer in the West Bank with the Palestinians and the Israelis, published by Beacon. And you begin your book by asserting that this is not a political book. Is it really possible to have a humanitarian position in the Middle East and not get caught up in politics?
Yeah, it is. It's hard. I mean, it was less hard for me, I suppose, because there was, in a way, a logical follow-on from being a journalist for so many years that it's...
I mean, the whole business about being objective.
Yeah, of trying to be objective. But, I mean, I know international law as well. Or, I mean, not much, but I know what it says. So one can, you know, do the politics and do the math about what's really going on there. But yes, I found it very easy to see both sides, and I've spent so many years with soldiers of one kind or another in various parts of the world that, yeah, I found it easy to... I wanted to get behind the uniform, behind the rhetoric, and behind the politics, which is kind of what led me to do the book. But yeah, I think it is possible to, at least in my position, which was just as a facilitator for humanitarian aid, working for an agency that deals only with humanitarian aid and did not have a political agenda. A lot of the Palestinians actually criticized us for that. I mean, they would sometimes just blow up at me. They say, we don't need you here with your humanitarian aid. We need you to solve, you know, to end the occupation. And I'd say, well, look, that's not what we do.
And then settlers yelled Nazi at you, Jewish settlers.
Oh, yes.
So everybody saw you from their own, filtered through their own experiences and own political views. Is that why you went back to the West Bank in 2006? Were you hoping to gain another perspective because you weren't, this didn't involve working in the area?
Yes, and it's 2006, and again, this year, I just came back last month in September, and yes, because when I was with the UN, I was sort of precluded from asking or doing certain interviews. I mean, I couldn't function as a journalist, and actually, I had no intention of writing a book at that point. So, but that's why I went back, because I wanted to do interviews on both sides in 2006.
And among the people you interviewed was a man you call Ahmed M. Why can't he get papers to live in Israel?
Oh, goodness, it's a long story. I actually just saw him again a couple of weeks ago. He's still mopping floors in a big office complex in East Jerusalem.
What should he be doing by training?
Well, if things had worked out the way he wanted to, he would have been a Soviet-trained doctor. At one point, he had a scholarship to study medicine in Moscow, and he couldn't get an exit visa from the Israeli authorities to go, so that fell through, and then something else fell through. But his problem is that he is a West Banker, as they say. He has West Bank ID. His wife is what's called a Jerusalemite. She is a Palestinian, an Arab, who has Jerusalem papers. But he did not have the legal right, according to the Israeli authorities, to sleep overnight in Jerusalem.
Even though he's married to a woman who lives there?
Yes, that does not automatically confer the right to live there. Now, he could work there because his permit, his various papers of the different types, say that he's allowed to work there, but that he had to leave, I don't know, by 7 p.m. or something. So then that was finally in 2006 about to be sorted out, and now I just heard a couple of weeks ago he's wearing a long face again, that he's paid a lawyer, I don't know, thousands of dollars, and it's sort of still is dragging on.
And you also spoke to a Palestinian architect, a woman named Hedaya. What have the difficulties that she's encountered in her lifetime taught her about the situation in the Middle East?
Well, Hedaya, who she and her husband and their kids have become good friends of mine now over the years, she was an architect. And she lives in Jenin in the far north of the West Bank, not in the refugee camp, but just outside the camp. And she was involved in, she worked for UNRWA at the time as a Palestinian, and she helped design new houses for the houses that were destroyed in this big military operation in 2002. And I think, I mean, her experiences are, she feels just well and truly stuck, you know. I mean, she can go to visit relatives in Jordan, but it is just such a hassle, as is coming back. And she, another reason, actually, I wrote the book, come to think of it, I hadn't thought of this before, was because of her kids. I mean, three very nice kids who are, I guess, now about, 11, 8, and 6, something like that. And they have stayed completely out of this fray, no politics. They've stayed completely away from the uprising. And this is an area where tanks and armored personnel carriers speeding through the streets all the time, a great deal of violence. They've had their house occupied and searched many times, particularly during 2002. So she's tired. She's tired and depressed, although she has managed to keep her kids out of this, and they're, I don't know, they're like any kids you'd meet in any country I can think of.
Can't she just go somewhere else? Is it impossible for Zaha Hadid, one of the leading architects of the world, comes from the Middle East, and she lives in Europe and works. She's established her career out of London.
I suppose she could, if she could find a job somewhere else that where she would be sponsored and then get out. But her husband is a surgeon, and he's still trying to maintain a practice there. And as the Hadaya keeps telling me and their kids, they say, look, this is Palestine. I mean, this is our home. We don't have a formal state, but this is where we live. So they would like many Palestinians, an awful lot are emigrating, but many as well want an independent state. They want to build this place into something, and that's where they stay.
You open the book with the story of a murder attempt you witnessed your first week on the job. What was different about that than the other violent acts you witnessed?
Well, I had seen plenty of violence, I mean, acute violence, over many years before I came there, but this one I found particularly shocking. It was, and there's a bit of background to this. A couple of weeks before that, and the day after I arrived in Jerusalem, or the day before I arrived in Jerusalem, Palestinian militants assassinated Israel's tourism minister, Rehavim Ze'evi, very right-wing guy, but anyway, they assassinated him. And the country was in a total uproar about this, and they were also in an uproar about attacks on settlers everywhere. So this attempted murder that I witnessed was a car driving in front of us, and up in the West Bank, and a settler coming the other way pitched a rock the size of a grapefruit through the windshield of the taxi and hit the driver in the head, and he survived. But it was after all the wars I had either seen or been involved in one way or another, it was the first time I had seen certainly two civilians, one of them attempt to kill another one.
You wrote in your introduction that in a way every suicide bombing was a gift for Ariel Sharon's Likud coalition. I guess because they use that as a justification for some of their policies. But then Ariel Sharon left Likud. Was he seeing that this was a hopeless situation, that something had to be done?
I don't think so. I think Ariel Sharon was too much of a strategist for that. And Sharon, who had been a long time supporter of development of the settlement enterprise in the West Bank, perhaps he had seen Gaza as being a bit of a liability, but I think Sharon also saw it as a way to help solidify the settler enterprise movement in the West Bank and expand it. So strategically, that was what has happened and what actually continues to this day.
My guest is Philip C. Winslow. His book, Victory for Us is to See You Suffer, published by Beacon. Well, how many settlers are estimated to be living in the West Bank?
There are 121 settlements, official settlements in the West Bank, and there are about 200,000 settlers in these 121 settlements. There are an additional 195,000, or call it 200,000, in East Jerusalem. So that's, what, 250,000 in the West Bank and East Jerusalem.
Do you have any idea how much Israeli taxpayers are paying for the upkeep of the settlements and the protection of them?
Staggering amounts of money, huge amounts of money. The one and I've never seen this figure contradicted, that's cited all the time, is somewhere in the neighborhood of $556 million a year. That's a year. Now, that's on, you know, infrastructure like all these fancy roads that connect the settlements and various other, incentives offered for people to settle our cheap, you know, subsidized housing and that sort of thing. So, I mean, it's costing the state of Israel an enormous amount of money.
And what do the majority of Israelis feel about those settlements? Do they all think this is a good idea?
Well, they do. This is a very complex part of the equation because Israel's coalition or Israel's system of government, which a government, including the current one of Ehud Olmert, survive on coalition politics, is driven, you might say, by the settlers. They are an enormously powerful movement. Various of the religious and right-wing parties support the settler enterprise. And for a government to oppose this, it's very difficult. But ordinary Israelis, I must say, they keep voting for this to continue. They don't vote them out. I think, but there are many...
Although it's kind of like a 51-49% generally in the elections, isn't it?
I must say, I don't know what the... Yes, I don't know the percentages, but an awful lot of Israelis, secular, left-wing, and even some religious Israelis, Jewish Israelis, are opposed to the settlements, but not enough to tip the balance. I know an awful lot of Israelis who see this as something that is helping to destroy their country and their dream of a Jewish state.
So are the flashpoints really Jewish fundamentalists against Islamic fundamentalists?
No, I don't think so. Although, various people, including some Israeli authors, argue that the messianic, that there is a group of messianic Jews there who are, you know, really believe that this, that God promised them this land and that it is their land and they're unshakable in this. But I do not think at all, I've seen no evidence that it's a standoff between Jewish fundamentalists and Islamic. I mean, there are plenty on both sides. I mean, there's a good friend of mine, a longtime Israeli lefty and peace activist, I mean, told me a week ago, he said we have a symmetry of extremists.
Well, David Grossman, the wonderful Israeli novelist, has told me on the show that he thinks that the answer, as crazy as it may sound, is to come up with a two-nation solution, accept the fact that there'll be quite a bit of violence from the extremists on both sides, and then it'll die down because in the end people will see it's in their best interest to actually have peace.
I agree with most of that. I think certainly a two-state solution.
I may be simplifying what he said also.
No, well, but I understand what you mean, and I think a two-state solution, nobody, I mean, this may not be a perfect solution, but it's the only one there is that anybody has come up with. And I think, and quite frankly, I think that the Palestinians, there's a problem in Gaza where the Palestinians still, I mean, these militants firing rockets across into Israel. This is something that the Palestinians need to fix and need to stop doing. But I honestly think that if Israel signaled that it was going to end the occupation, that I think there would be a lot less violence than people think. And actually on both sides. I mean, going back to the evacuation of Jews from the Sinai and certainly in Gaza, yes, there was a big uproar for a few weeks, and actually it died down.
But perhaps because of the change in Palestinian politics with Mahmoud Abbas in control of the West Bank, that might be a little easier, although you still would have Hamas, which says it wants to drive the Israelis into the sea in Gaza. So this would perhaps be a piecemeal peace, or do you think if a peace was arrived at, Hamas might very well say, well, you know, okay, we'll be realistic and we'll join in on this because we want a piece of the Palestinian nation's pie.
Sure. I mean, Yasser Arafat in 1988, after all, I mean, he did recognize Israel. And although whatever you want to say about Arafat, you know, that was that. I think Hamas, one thing that is sure to continue the stalemate as we're going now is to isolate Hamas. Yes, they have been branded as a terrorist organization, but who says you shouldn't negotiate with your enemies? And I think getting Hamas, and if things started to open up, this could change.
Well, where does your title, Victory for Us is to See You Suffer, fit into all of this? Doesn't that suggest that the lines have been drawn rather hard?
the lines have been drawn rather hard, and there's an awful lot of hot rhetoric and really deep, deep bitter feelings on both sides, one to the other. But the title originated with back in the 80s or the early 90s, I guess, with in a discussion in London between a couple of Palestinians and an Israeli. The Israeli was Ami Ayalon, who was the head of the Israeli Shin Bet Security Service and a retired career naval officer, Israeli naval officer. One of the Palestinians who was there was his partner in a peace venture called Sari Nusseibeh, whose autobiography, Once Upon a Country, just came out recently. There was another Palestinian there as well who came up to Ami Ayalon at a coffee break and said, "Ami, we won." And Ami Ayalon, he was a real hard-bitten old negotiator. He said, "What do you mean you won? You've lost a lot of people and we've lost a lot. What do you mean by victory?" And without batting an eye, the Palestinian guy said, "Victory for us is to see you suffer. For the first time in 50 years, we, the Palestinians, are not the only ones suffering in the Middle East." Now, as horrific as that sounds,
so Ayalon, that's a justification for intifada.
Well, yes, and a justification for some of the horrific violence, or if not a justification, an explanation of. And Ayalon got thinking about it, and he and his wife both said, "Well, there is an element, small or big, small probably, but there's an element of revenge, punishment and counter-punishment." And I had many times for my 2.5 years there started wondering, you know, you started to forget who started this thing. But that there was an element of that. However, it's more complicated than that.
And you get the sense that both sides say the other side started it, and you can probably go back 2,000 years if you really want to see where it began. Victory for us is to see you suffer, if in the West Bank with the Palestinians and the Israelis, is Philip C. Winslow's book. Thank you so much. On tomorrow's show, Academy Award-winning director Sidney Lumet is joined by Ethan Hawke and Philip Seymour Hoffman, the stars of his latest movie, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. Then Colin Thubron tells us about the 8 months he spent on the 7,000-mile-long Silk Route, plus a look at the Jewish Museum's Camille Pissarro exhibit and our latest underreported. By the way, if you've missed something on the show or just want to hear something again, you can listen to archives of past programs on WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English and Blake Neeschick. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Julia Corcoran, Rory Bernstein, Samantha Morgenstern, and Scott Goldberg. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.